Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading the April 2022 edition of True West Magazine. This is their annual travel edition of True West. On the True Grit Trails by Johnny D. Boggs. Travel across Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Colorado and discover the real and imagined locations of the iconic novel and 1969 film's locations. People do not give it credence that a freelance writer would ever leave home on an assignment for a Western History magazine to follow the trail of a 14-year-old girl's quest for justice, since that girl and her one-eyed deputy marshal friend never really existed, except in Charles Portis's imagination. I will say this to travel writers. It does not happen every day. While Arkansas has its own True Grit Trail, Arkansas 22 from Dardanelle to Fort Smith, and four Dardanelle High School students came up with a route to Oklahoma's Winding Stair Mountains for the Yell County Historical Society, I follow Rand McNally, Maddie Ross, and Paramount Pictures, and discover how much Portis got right. In 1968, Simon & Schuster published True Grit, the 34-year-old ex-Arkansas newspaper journalist's second novel. Reviews were spectacular. A small masterpiece of American humor. A new kind of Western. A horse opera with a difference. As touching as it is irreverently amusing. And speaks to every American who can read. In the novel, 14-year-old Maddie Ross's father is murdered in Fort Smith by hired hand Tom Cheney. "There is trash for you," Maddie says. Maddie and Yarnell Poindexter, a black hired hand, leave the Ross's 480-acre farm in Yell County by train from Dardanelle to Fort Smith. So let's hit the trail. Arkansas. Had they traveled as the crow flies, Maddie says, they would have passed Mount Nebo, where we had a little summer house so Mama could get away from the mosquitoes, and Mount Magazine, the highest point in Arkansas. Yes, it's 2,753 feet above sea level. Cabins, including many built in the 1930s, are available for rent at Mount Nebo State Park, which offers views of the Arkansas River Valley. Nebo became popular as a resort in 1889 when the Summit Park Hotel opened. It was not popular, however, with Cherokees, Choctaws, Creeks, Seminoles, and Chickasaws, who passed Nebo on their forced removal from the southeast to present-day Oklahoma. Farther west, what's now Mount Magazine State Park, attracted French explorers and hunters in the 17th and 18th centuries, and permanent settlers after the Civil War. Fort Smith did not impress Maddie. All the windows need washing. But it has impressed many Western history buffs. Established in 1872, the Federal Court for the Western District of Arkansas was first headquartered on the grounds of a military post, now part of Fort Smith National Historical Site. Barracks were turned into the courtroom, 1875 to 1889, for Judge Isaac Parker, who ruled the district from 1872 to 1896. The basement's mess halls became the jail, aptly named Hell on the Border. Maddie witnesses the hanging of three prisoners, performed by George Maladin, who dropped 60 of the 79, sometimes six at a time, during Parker's reign. The gallows, now reconstructed, first went up in 1873, then were replaced in 1886. Maddie hires drunken, one-eyed Deputy Marshal Reuben J. Rooster Cogburn to go after Cheney for a reward. That won't be easy because Cheney is riding with Lucky Ned Pepper's train-robbing gang. A Texas Ranger named LeBeouf, seeking Cheney for another murder, joins up. They ferry across the Arkansas River and enter Indian territory on the Fort Gibson Road, if you could call it a road. Oklahoma. Maddie wasn't the only person who complained about the 208-mile road from Little Rock to Fort Gibson. Vanita's Weekly Chieftain opined in 1888, "To call the Fort Gibson Road a stage road is a misnomer. The roads of our nation are but a standing shame and disgrace." The posse skirts through the Sanboys Mountains, check out Robbers Cave State Park north of Wellbutrin, and captures Emmett Quincy and Moon, unfortunately for those soon-dead outlaws, while Pepper's boys are robbing the Katy Flyer at Wagner's Ranch. Wagner City Historical Museum, started where the Katy, also known as Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railway, and Kansas and Arkansas Valley Railway's trucks crossed. The Flyer, however, didn't start running until 1893, rushing travelers to Chicago's World's Fair. Our heroes travel on to McClester's store on the MK and T railroad tracks. In what's now McAllister, James J. McAllister opened a store in 1869 on the Texas Road before Katy ran a line nearby in 1872. By 1886, Muskogee's Indian Record called McAllister's doubtless the largest store building in the Indian Territory. From McAllister's, the trio turns east for the winding Stair Mountains, where today the Talamina National Scenic Byway runs 54 miles from Tallahena, Oklahoma to Mena, Arkansas. Justice Revenge comes in Homeric fashion. LaBeouf gets a headache and Cogburn saves Maddie's life, though her right arm is amputated. Epilogue. In the final pages, Maddie travels to Memphis, Tennessee in 1903, hoping to see Rooster, who is appearing in a Wild West show headlined by Cole Younger and Frank James. Alas, she learns that Rooster died in Jonesboro, Arkansas, a few days earlier. On May 13, 1903, in Jonesboro, Arkansas State University Museum, fully 10,000 people caught the Cole Younger and Frank James historical Wild West for two performances. It was pronounced generally as a fake, a newspaper correspondent observed, and an imposition upon the people. The troupe hit Memphis on May 25th, where, the commercial appeal noted, spectators got over the disappointment in not seeing Frank James and Cole Younger hold up a train or blow a safe. Maddie reburies Rooster on the family plot near Dardendale State Park, where Maddie's adventure begins and ends. The 1969 Films Trail. "True Grit is good enough for me. It is good enough for you," Charles Elliott wrote for Life magazine in 1968. "And if it isn't good enough for some movie company, then the free enterprise system really is going to hell." Free enterprise was fine. Portis reportedly earned $300,000 for movie rights. Directed by Henry Hathaway from a screenplay by Marguerite Roberts, blacklisted in 1951 for refusing to cooperate with the House Un-American Activities Committee, True Grit was released in 1969 and won John Wayne, as Rooster, his only Academy Award. Kim Darby played Maddie, and Glenn Campbell tried to play LaBeouf. Instead of Arkansas, Oklahoma, the production headed to Colorado's Rockies for location filming, even though, as the Ouray County Herald reported, this region doesn't resemble either Arkansas or Oklahoma. Set construction began in August 1968, with principal photography starting the following month. Signs at one of the more centrally located motels said, "Welcome Paramount Pictures." Nancy Sparks wrote for the Wichita, Kansas Eagle in October 1968. The sign at our motel said, "Background music, shuffleboard, and dial telephones." Clearly, it wasn't John Wayne's headquarters. The livery stable and gallows went up at Ridgeway's Hartwell Park, while across Lena Street, a courthouse facade was erected, and buildings were turned into a saloon and grocery. The jail wagon that brings in Rooster's prisoners is displayed at the Ouray County Ranch History Museum, formerly a railroad depot. Other film sites are in town. Visit Ridgeway's Visitors Center for details. Outside of Ridgeway, the Ross Place is off Lost Dollar Road. The ruins of McAllister's store on County Road 60X. And you can recognize the site of Rooster's shootout with Ned Pepper's bunch at Debbie's Meadow near Owl Creek's Passes Summit. For the actual courthouse exteriors and the interior staircase where Maddie accosts Rooster, drive to Ouray, Ouray County Museum. The courthouse is at 4th Street and 6th Avenue. The snake pit that almost dooms Maddie is on private property off Campbird Road, while the ferry scenes are underwater at Blue Mesa Reservoir between Montrose and Gunnison. You don't have to be a True Grit fan, however, to appreciate the area's history. This ends my true account of how I followed a fictional trail, actually two trails, when regular unleaded was $2.79 a gallon. True West, April 2022 edition, An Arizona Adventure by Peter Corbett. The Earp Brothers Trail from Prescott to Tombstone is a treasure trove of historic sites. Wyatt Earp and his lawmen, brothers, and Doc Holliday are best known for Turbulent Times and Tombstone. But we thought it would be fun to follow their path across Arizona from Prescott to Tombstone and across Cochise County north to Wilcox. Buckle up for a road trip that's cushy compared to an 1880 trek. The Earp clan had a short stay in Prescott in 1879 before moving to Tombstone in late November, but they are well remembered today for their time in the Arizona Territory capital. Doc Holliday was on and off in Prescott between November 1879 and September 1880 before leaving to join the Earps in Tombstone. Wyatt and Doc walked the streets of Prescott, including Whiskey Row, a string of Montezuma Street saloons. Although today's Palace Saloon was built after a 1900 fire, it has its roots in the 1874 Cabinet Saloon, a likely stop for the Prescott newcomers. Visitors can learn about the Earps and Prescott at the Western Heritage Center and Charlotte Hall Museum. The migration of the Earps and Holliday from Prescott to Tombstone took them through Phoenix, Tucson, and Benson. Travelers can roughly follow their route across Arizona on today's paved highways. The Earps traveled in three wagons on the stage route out of Prescott and onto Tombstone. Prescott to Phoenix. The road the Earps traveled cut southeast from Prescott through the nearby mining towns of Dewey, Humboldt, and Mayer. Today, State Route 69 roughly covers the same ground for 50 miles from Prescott to Interstate 17 at Cortez Junction. The old stage route heads south at Mayer, traveling west of I-17 to Bumblebee and Black Canyon City. Adventurous travelers with back road maps can follow this route. It's unpaved, rocky in spots, and not recommended during severe weather, rain, snow, or extreme heat. A high-clearance vehicle is advisable. The brutal stagecoach ride from Prescott to Phoenix took close to 30 hours. Highwaymen were known to rob the stage for its strongbox and pilfer passenger valuables. Delays were not uncommon at the Agua Fria River when storms or spring runoff flooded the low water crossing. Today, the drive to Phoenix on SR 69 and I-17 takes about 90 minutes as you descend from Mile High Prescott to the capital city at 1,135 feet. It's a scenic drive with wide open high desert views and a wild ride down the steep incline into Black Canyon City, where saguaros punctuate the desert terrain. In modern Phoenix, there's virtually nothing left of the circa 1880 small town the Earps and Doc Holliday passed through. Phoenix to Tucson. Travelers can follow I-17 to I-10 southeast to Tucson for a trip of just under 2 hours on a congested freeway. The alternative is U.S. 60 east through Mesa to Florence Junction and turning south on lightly traveled State Route 79. This leads to Florence and its well-preserved historic district and McFarland State Historic Park. Don't miss the Tom Mix Memorial, 17 miles south of Florence. This is where the silent movie star died in a horrific one-car crash on October 12, 1940. The marker reads, "In memory of Tom Mix, whose spirit left his body on this spot, and whose characterization and portrayals in life served to better fix memories of the Old West in the minds of living men." The scenic drive from Florence to Oracle Junction follows the Pinal Pioneer Parkway for 42 miles. The flora along this route is often thick with wildflowers from February into April if enough rainfall has soaked the desert. On either route, head for the Tucson train depot downtown. On the track side, bronze statues of Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday wielding long guns stand as if ready for a gunfight. This public art marks the March 20th, 1882 slaying of Frank Stillwell, who Wyatt Earp believed killed his brother Morgan. Wyatt, with his brothers Virgil and Warren, Holliday, and two other men, were escorting Morgan's casket on the train to California and were tipped off that Stillwell was waiting for them in Tucson. Stillwell was outfoxed and paid the ultimate price. He was riddled with bullets as the westbound Southern Pacific train pulled out of the station. The Tucson Weekly Citizen shared the news on March 26, 1882. A young man by the name of Frank Stillwell, aged about 26 years, suddenly terminated his somewhat erratic career a little west of the depot last Monday by death from gunshot wounds. Stillwell's body was found at the railroad crossing west of Porter's Hotel. Both Porter's and the 1882 train depot are gone. The current depot was built in 1907 and restored in 2004 to its 1940s look. It houses an Amtrak station, a restaurant, and the Southern Arizona Transportation Museum. Tucson to Benson and Tombstone. The route east covers 50 miles of I-10 to Benson, generally along the Butterfield Overland Mail route established in 1858. There were 27 stagecoach stations across Arizona, and it took about 4 days to cross Arizona at an average speed of 4.5 miles per hour, according to the Arizona Daily Star. Benson, a town of about 300 people in 1880, was the transfer spot for the stagecoach traveling to Tombstone and beyond. The New Mexico and Arizona Railroad in 1882 linked Benson with Fairbanks south of Tombstone. The Benson Visitor Center is a good stop where one can learn more about railroad and Cochise County history. Bob Nilsson, Benson's tourism supervisor and a local historian, is eager to share the stories of the region's outlaws. They include Pearl Hart, the female bandit who, with accomplished Joe Boot, robbed the Globe Florence stagecoach in 1899. They were quickly captured near Benson. The Benson to Tombstone drive takes 30 minutes. That same trick took hours on the stagecoach and was subject to holdups by desperados. Upon arriving in Tombstone, visitors are advised to park their rigs, put on boots, and be the cowgirl or cowboy they've always wanted to be. Take a stagecoach ride. Visit the OK Corral. Don't be alarmed by mock gunfights on Allen Street. Grab a bite to eat or drink at the Crystal Palace, Big Nose Kate's, Wyatt Earp's Oriental Saloon, or Doc Holliday's Saloon. We like Tombstone Courthouse State Historic Park for its sobering history of the violence that plagued the town in the 1880s. Tombstone has its own special tombstone for founder Ed Schifflin. He ignored warnings about prospecting in Apache country. Skeptics warned him he'd only find his own tombstone. Instead, he discovered a rich vein of silver in 1877, and Tombstone was born. The Schifflin Memorial is about 2 miles from town. Take Allen Street northwest beyond the pavement and follow the signs. Another side trip is a 9-mile jaunt on a paved county road to the former town sites of Charleston and Millville. Two mills were built there to process ore, relying on water from the San Pedro River. An 1887 earthquake leveled the town's adobe buildings. There are a few ruins left. Tombstone to Bisbee and Douglas. Bisbee is 23 miles southeast of Tombstone on State Route 80, and it's another 28 miles to the border town of Douglas. The queen of the copper camps, Bisbee has transformed itself from a mining town to a haven for artists and counterculture types. Tourism drives the economy with a collection of historic hotels, restaurants, bars, residences, galleries, and shops scattered on steep slopes along Tombstone Canyon and into Brewery Gulch. Steep staircases and narrow alleys wind through the town. Make reservations to take the Queen Mine underground tours and visit the open Lavender Pit to gain perspective on Bisbee's mining bonanza. The Lavender Pit alone produced 75 million tons of ore between 1954 and 1970. The 1902 Copper Queen is Bisbee's most notable hotel with 48 rooms. It's home to the requisite ghost tales and a spirited saloon and patio for the undead. We're also big fans of the Bisbee Coffee Company and Cafe Roca, which is only open on weekends. Down the road in Douglas is another historic hotel. The Gadsden opened in 1907 and was restored after a 1928 fire. The hotel has its own ghost stories and an apocryphal tale of Pancho Villa that rode his horse into the lobby and chipped the marble stairway. One of Douglas's hometown icons is Stan Jones. He is the Death Valley Park Ranger who had a second career in songwriting and Western movies after his song Ghost Riders in the Sky became a mega hit in 1949. Vaughn Monroe's cover of Ghost Riders sold 1.8 million records over 2 months. Jones's career waned by the late 50s, coinciding with the demise of Westerns. He died in 1963 and is buried in the Julia Page Memorial Park, southwest of Dolores Avenue and 3rd Street. His ground-level tombstone is the first quadrant at the northeast edge of the cemetery, north of the Garden of Devotion sign, and about 30 feet east of the middle road. Douglas is also the jumping-off point for visiting the Slaughter Ranch, once home of the legendary Cochise County lawman Texas John Slaughter, who presided in the late 1880s. Follow 15th Street east of town for 15 miles to reach the ranch. It's open for tours from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Tuesday to Saturday. Douglas to Wilcox. A final leg of the trip follows State Route 80 north to Rodeo, Mexico, and connects with I-10 westbound to Wilcox, Arizona. This is the hometown of the late Rex Allen, the Arizona cowboy, who starred in 19 westerns for Republic Pictures in the 1950s. His successful career as the last of the singing cowboys is chronicled in the excellent Rex Allen Museum and Wilcox Cowboy Hall of Fame. Finally, this is one more stop where the Earp brothers made their mark. Wyatt's youngest brother, Warren, lived in Wilcox around 1900. He had been with his Earp brothers when they killed Frank Stillwell at Tucson in 1882. Warren was shot and killed at the headquarters saloon in Wilcox on July 6, 1900. That saloon burned down in 1940, and the replacement building is now the tasting room for Birds and Barrels Vineyard. Warren Earp is buried in the Wilcox Pioneer Cemetery. Ask at the museum for directions to his gravesite. Happy trails. A side trip down the White Spar route to Wickenburg. Wickenburg is a 60-mile drive south of Prescott on State Route 89, but drivers on a road trip would be hard-pressed to cover that distance in an hour. Don't try it. The highway, once referred to as the White Spar Route, has murderous curves as it descends more than 3,300 feet from the Prescott Pines to the desert. Take your time, enjoy the scenery. Stop at the Granite Mountain Hot Shots Memorial State Park as you descend Yarnell Hill. Once you reach Wickenburg, we recommend a visit to the Desert Caballeros Western Museum. It's staging an exhibit marking the 150th anniversary of Henry Wickenburg discovering gold and opening the Vulture Mine. Tours of the Vulture City ghost town south of Wickenburg are offered daily. If team roping is your jam, check out the schedules for local arenas. For overnight visits, Wickenburg offers some of Arizona's best guest ranches, KL Bar Ranch, Flying E Ranch, and Ranchos de los Caballeros. 1883, The Wagons West Story. True West Magazine, April 2022 edition, by Henry C. Park. Innovative filmmaker Taylor Sheridan's new series captures the grit and the glory of the trail. When True West spoke to creator Taylor Sheridan in August of 2021 on the eve of principal photography, no one knew how 1883 would turn out, or how the public would respond to it. At this writing, the last few episodes have not yet aired, but the audience has spoken. 1883 had the biggest cable premiere since 2015, and the numbers remain high. The Yellowstone prequel, which follows the Ragan trip west by the current Dutton's great-great-grandparents, has been called the best miniseries since Lonesome Dove. My reaction was surprise, says film historian C. Courtney Joyner, because it ain't a gun-em-down Western story. It's a pioneer story, a wagon train story. That's really cool because it's an area that has not been touched in decades. The series has scored well with the much-desired younger adult demographic, perhaps because the subject matter is surprisingly familiar to them. Since 1971, 65 million copies of The Oregon Trail, the computer game, and school staple have been sold. Still, that's not television. No one's made the Wagons West story in a way that's really been impactful, notes Sheridan. True, no one's done it in a long time, but it has been done brilliantly twice before. 1923's The Covered Wagon and 1930's The Big Trail have set the bar dauntingly high. Both films are epics, with casts and crews in the thousands, beautiful locations and wonderful directors, James Cruz and Raoul Walsh, respectively. Visually enthralling, Covered Wagon was filmed by D.W. Griffith's cameraman, Carl Brown, and Big Trail was shot in a 70mm format. They are thrilling to watch even today. Of course, beyond the enormous budgets, those filmmakers had an advantage over Taylor Sheridan. Says Joyner, the filmmakers were in a time when these were actual events. The breaking of the West was only 60 years before they made the movie. They had Civil War veterans in those movies. In fact, the nearly 100 prairie schooners and Covered Wagon were genuine relics of the wagon trains, mainly driven by owners who had made the trip as children. It's worth noting a scene that occurs 5 minutes into Covered Wagon. As the pioneers wait impatiently to begin their trek, admiring a plow, the scene dissolves to a title. Far out on the westward trail stands another plow that bravely started for Oregon. It's being examined by several Indians. One says, in a title card, "This monster weapon will bury the buffalo, uproot the forest, and level the mountain. The pale face who comes with this evil medicine must be slain, or the red man perishes." There is no parallel in any other film on the subject. Ironically, while Wagon was a hit, the equally magnificent Trail was a bomb. Only two theaters in America could run the widescreen format. So few saw it, and its star, young John Wayne, was blamed and sentenced to 9 years at Republic Pictures. But 20 years later, the story of the wagon trains returned with John Ford's small but excellent Wagon Master, starring Ben Johnson and Harry Carey Jr., as horse traders reluctantly roped into leading a Mormon group to their promised land. Its third lead, Ward Bond, who'd been unbilled in Big Trail, would become a star as Major Adams on the tremendously popular series Wagon Train. A year later, Westward the Women, written by Frank Capra and directed by William Wellman, became the best and toughest of the later Wagon's West films. Robert Taylor's Wagon Master leading a caravan of women has much in common with 1883's Sam Elliott doing the same for a group of ill-prepared German immigrants. Both men are as hard and mean as it takes to get the job done and willing to kill pioneers who don't follow their rules. The other Wagon's West films all have their virtues. Disney's Westward Ho, The Wagons, features an Indian attack directed dynamically by Yakima Canet, which was much improved when Walt let him reshoot it, allowing Indians and settlers to actually get hurt. Andrew McLellan's The Way West, though ruined by the studio cutting 20 minutes from the opening, has great sequences, including the rope lowering of wagons from cliffs to the valley, hundreds of feet below, although it can't compete with the Big Trail's enormity. 10 wagons lowered at once, with children being handed down on ropes in the same shot. As Sheridan explains, telling these stories well begins with knowledge of the history of filmmaking. You go back to John Ford, Ben Johnson. Everyone knew a lot more back then and knew how to film it. Now you've got people trying to make Westerns who have never seen a horse in person. Whenever I write anything, I have to factor in first and foremost, is it achievable? I operate from that standpoint. And yes, with 1883, Taylor Sheridan has achieved something wonderful. True West, April 2022 edition. Leavenworth, Kansas, by Peter Corbett. The first city of the Sunflower State celebrates its Western heritage. Leavenworth is known as the first city of Kansas, but its importance in settling the West transcends that provincial title. The town was founded in 1854, 27 years after Colonel Henry Leavenworth led a garrison of soldiers from Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, to a site overlooking the Missouri River northwest of present-day Kansas City. There he established Cantonment Leavenworth in 1827, later called Fort Leavenworth, to protect the western trade routes from Plains Indians and caravans traveling on the Santa Fe and Oregon trails. Fort Leavenworth, still operating after 195 years, has been described as the most significant military post in the Trans-Mississippi West and the post that opened the West. Colonel Leavenworth, after defeating the Pawnee Indians in a brutal campaign, was named a brigadier general, but word of that promotion never reached him before his death in 1834. That was two decades before his namesake town was established south of the fort. Leavenworth City, as it was initially known, was established amid bitter conflict over Kansas and Nebraska entering the Union as slave or free states. Today, Leavenworth is known nationally for its fort, the oldest west of the Mississippi, and the federal penitentiary, which incarcerated notorious criminals George Machine Gun Kelly, George Bugs Moran, and Robert Stroud, better known as the Birdman of Alcatraz, who had an aviary at Leavenworth before he was transferred to Alcatraz. The military prison, nicknamed the Castle, opened in 1875 and operated until 2002 when a new facility opened. Its prisoners built the first federal penitentiary between 1897 and 1920. Prison guards would march 300 inmates 3 miles to the prison construction site to build the federal pen. But today, Leavenworth has more to offer than cell blocks and guard towers. Fort Leavenworth is considered a national treasure with historic sites and homes, a world-class museum, the nation's premier Buffalo Soldier monument, and breathtaking views overlooking the Missouri River, said Christy Lee, Leavenworth tourism director. A central historic district includes more than 100 homes and buildings from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. That includes the 1869 mansion of Fred Harvey, the entrepreneur who opened 50 Harvey House restaurants across the West to greatly improve dining for Santa Fe Railroad passengers. Leavenworth's beautiful 1888 Union Pacific Railroad depot was restored and repurposed as a community center and gymnasium in 1988. The restored Great Western Manufacturing Company warehouse, built between 1860 and 1910, formerly made cast iron stoves for Western settlers. It had housed a saloon and craft brewery, but those have closed. Two of Leavenworth's popular locations and attractions are the Frontier Army Museum and the C.W. Parker Carousel Museum. The Frontier Army Museum explains the opening of the Western Frontier from 1804 to the early 20th century and Fort Leavenworth's role in that history. It preserves one of the finest collections of 19th century military artifacts in the country, according to Lee. That includes a vast collection of horse-drawn vehicles that were repaired and stored in the Fort Leavenworth wagon shop. It also has a World War I era Jenny biplane. The lighter side of life is celebrated at the C.W. Parker Carousel Museum near the Leavenworth Landing Park on the Missouri River. A centerpiece of the museum is a refurbished 1913 C.W. Parker Carousel. Charles Wallace Parker, 1864 to 1932, moved his business from Abilene, Kansas to Leavenworth in 1910, bringing 75 employees and a payroll of $3,000 per month. The Parker plant was affectionately known as the Wooden Horse Ranch for the business's finely carved equines. Parker's company built as many as 1,000 carousels and other equipment for amusement parks and carnivals. Over the decades, he was tagged as the Amusement King, Carousel King, and Napoleon of Amusement Devices. Parker died in 1932, but his son Paul kept the business operating in Leavenworth until 1955. The Buffalo Soldier Monument at Fort Leavenworth recognizes the contributions of the Army's 9th and 10th Cavalry and 24th and 25th Infantry. The Black Regiments were formed in 1886, including the 10th Cavalry at Fort Leavenworth. The monument, dedicated by General Colin Powell in 1992, includes a 13-foot bronze of a Buffalo soldier on a charging horse created by Texas sculptor Eddie Dixon. Fort Leavenworth is restricting visitation because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Until further notice, only visitors with legitimate business are allowed on the base. Fort Leavenworth is also the site of one of 14 national cemeteries created in 1862. The remains of 8 Medal of Honor winners are interred at Fort Leavenworth National Cemetery. A 12-foot granite marker decorated with an eagle marks the grave of Brigadier General Henry Leavenworth. True West, April 2022 edition. Trailing Them North by Johnny D. Boggs. Follow the Western Cattle Trail from Bandera, Texas to Miles City, Montana. Blame It On Babesia Vegamina. That little parasitic protozoa found a home in ticks, which found a home on Texas Longhorn cattle, until the bloodsuckers jumped to new digs on domestic cattle in present-day Oklahoma, Kansas, or Missouri, and pretty much brought an end to the Shawnee and Chisholm cattle trails to Sedalia, Baxter Springs, Abilene, Ellsworth, Wichita, etc. Kansas beef and Babesia vegamina did not mix. The cattle became feverish, lost weight, turned anemic, passed blood in their urine, and died. Sick of Texans, Kansas established quarantine lines that prohibited herding Texas Longhorns through civilized country. Undeterred, Texas trail bosses simply moved west of the quarantine line until Kansas eventually banned all Texas herds in 1885, said goodbye to the Chisholm Trail, and inaugurated the Western Trail. The Eastern Chisholm Trail crossed the Red River at Spanish Fort or Red River Station in Montague County. Some Texans continued that route into Indian Territory, present-day Oklahoma, then turned on the Dodge City cutoff to avoid the quarantine line and angry Kansans. But soon a new trail emerged. Texas. Also known as the Dodge City Trail, Fort Griffin Trail, and Great Western Trail, the Western Trail begins in South Texas. How far south depends on who you ask or read. Feeder trails ran like fingers, and routes often depended on where the best grass could be found. But a good place to start is Bandera, which lives up to its Cowboy Capital of the World moniker with the Frontier Times Museum, which J. Marvin Hunter started in 1927. Hunter earned his place of honor among cowboy chroniclers by compiling and editing The Trail Drivers of Texas, a collection of trail-driving cowboy memoirs first published in 1924. A fair number of those cowpokes had Bandera County connections, which might explain why the Dixie Dude Ranch first opened in 1937, and many others have followed. The trail generally moved north to Kerrville, home of the Museum of Western Art, and Junction, home of the Kimball County Historical Museum, before crossing the San Saba River at Peg Leg Crossing east of Menard, home of Menardville Museum. From there, cowboys and cattle continued north, passing east of Abilene, Frontier, Texas, which took its name from the Kansas cow town of Chisholm Trail fame. Cowboys kept pushing these dogies north to Albany, home of the Old Jail Art Center, Fort Griffin, home of the Fort Griffin State Historical Park, Seymour, home of the Baylor County Museum, and Vernon, home of the Red River Valley Museum. North of Vernon, longhorns, horses, chuck wagons, and cowboys reached the Western's most famous location in Texas, Doan's Crossing on the Red River. The first house at Doan's was made of pickets with a dirt roof and floor of the same material. Corin F. Doan recalled, "The first winter we had no door, but a buffalo robe did service against the Northers." Doan and his uncle, Jonathan Doan, set up the trading post just south of the Red in 1878, roughly 4 years after John T. Little blazed the Dodge City Fort Griffin Western Trail by pushing a large herd of cattle from South Texas to the Red Cloud Agency in Nebraska. By the late 70s, Ida Ellen Rath wrote The Rath Trail, The Texas cowpunchers were driving tens of thousands of longhorns over this western trail. After stocking up on supplies, the cowboys crossed the Red into Indian territory. Oklahoma and Kansas. We kept our eyes open and managed to keep peace by giving Indians beef every day, F.M. Polk remembered. They would come to us 50 and 100 at a time. Some would ride with us all day, and they always asked for a cow, and of course we acted like we were glad to give it to them. Oklahomans put the trail along U.S. 183. Frederick, home of the Pioneer Townsite Museum, Hobart, Kiowa County Historical Museum, Clinton, Washita County Museum, or the Oklahoma 34, Altus, Museum of the Western Prairie, Elk City, Old Town Museum, Woodward, Plains Indians and Pioneers Museum. Well, ramrods could pick their own paths, and better grass trumped crowded trails. Either way, the herds eventually hit Fort Supply Historic Site, before striking Kansas, and for a while, no quarantines. The trail's early destination was Dodge City, Boot Hill Museum, the last of the great Kansas cow towns. Those of long experience in the West do not need to be told that the depraved of both sexes flocked to this wild and woolly frontier settlement, the New York Times wrote of Dodge City in 1889. 20 years ago, there was a class of vicious people west of the Mississippi River whose mission, it seemed, to be to settle in every new town, if only for a few days or hours. There were, apparently, as many women as men in this villainous tribe, which swooped down upon Dodge as soon as its name became known among the Great Western Trails. The trail continued into Nebraska, past present-day Crawford, Fort Robinson History Center, to the Union Pacific Railroad at Ogallala, Boot Hill Cemetery, where more cowboy debauchery awaited the young Texans. The sharpers and gamblers who have reached Ogallala from various points are always ready to accommodate the cowboys in their search for amusement, and they are fortunate if they do not leave a considerable of their wages with the Spanish Monte and Faro dealers, an American agriculturalist correspondent observed in 1879. Pointing them north. But the Western Trail wasn't finished. Many drivers herded beef north into Deadwood, Adams Museum, and the Black Hills of present-day South Dakota. Another branch turned northeast from the Ogallala bound for grazing land and ranches in Wyoming and Montana. The later trail went through present-day Rusk, Wyoming, Stagecoach Museum, and finally ended at Miles City, Montana, Range Riders Museum. If the importance of a cattle trail is to be measured by the number of animals passing over it on their way to market, Henry Sinclair Drago wrote in Great American Cattle Trails, then the Western Trail was second only to the Chisholm as the greatest of all American trails. How's that for anti-Western trail bias? Estimates of cattle on the Chisholm Trail run about 5 million, and the Western, that's 6 million to 7 million. Drago should have checked Paul I. Wellman's The Trampling Herd. Wellman wrote, more has been written of the Chisholm Trail than any of the other routes, but the Western Trail and Doan's Crossing in their day eclipsed that famous cattle highway. And all because of Babesia Boehmia. True West, April 2022 edition. Eat a Peach by Sherry Monahan. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Oklahoma became one of the nation's leaders in peach and stone fruit production. Fruit is not exactly the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Oklahoma, but during the pioneer days, farmers harvested and produced cherries, persimmons, ground cherries, peaches, plums, and more. Most of the fruit was grown for personal use until the latter part of the 1800s. After the land run of 1889, thousands of people rushed in to claim their land, and agriculture quickly advanced Oklahoma's economy. In 1907, the president of the State Board of Agriculture wrote, "Agriculture is and will be for years to come, if not forever, the leading industry in our state." By 1893, Oklahoma fruit orchards were still largely in their infancy. Many farmers started with peach and plum trees because they felt the soil was ripe for them to be bountiful. While many were already doing well in established counties, newer counties were still experimenting. J.M. Rice speculated that new farmers should plant small amounts of strawberries and blackberries because they didn't fare well in long, dry, windy spells. He also suggested grapes as well as apple and peach trees. By 1897, peaches were doing so well that many farmers called for a distillery to make peach brandy, so nothing went to waste. Even the local paper argued there was a great demand for it. By 1899, Guthrie opened a distillery, but it didn't last. In 1900, Julius Greaser, an Enid man, bought 20 bushels of peaches laden with worms, which he picked out. The Enid Weekly Wave wrote, "He is going to make peach brandy out of the peaches and is trying to sell the worms for fishing purposes. That will make horrible peach brandy." In 1904, Tecumseh resident Robert Wheeler wrote to the Western Fruit Grower magazine about his orchards and Oklahoma produce. He told them that Duke and Morello cherries did well as long as they were properly maintained. He also advised that pecan trees grew wild and in abundance, and several hundred bushels of pecans were shipped from his area each year. He added, "Last year, many of my apple, peach, and pear trees made over 4 feet of growth, and at this time, my peach trees are set quite full of good, healthy blossom buds, as are some of the plum trees. But I don't expect to harvest much this year, except from strawberries, blackberries, and grapes." In 1906, Oklahoma had a record peach crop from about 100,000 Alberta peach trees. The peaches from Guthrie and Logan County were shipped in 50 train cars. It was estimated that growers would earn about $30,000 for just that shipment. There could have been more shipped, but because the peaches ripened in 24 hours, many dropped to the ground and were not used. Local businessmen decided that was a waste, so they planned for a factory to can them and make preserves. The Fruit Trade Journal and Produce Record published this comment: "They were given away to anybody and everybody who would gather and carry them away. There was not a canning factory in Logan County, nor was there a brandy distillery or vinegar factory." Peaches and other fruits became so bountiful that local businesses started offering peach products, and restaurants offered them to their diners. Some sold peach ice cream, apple and peach pie, strawberry shortcake, and blackberry, cherry, strawberry, and plum preserves. And now here is a recipe. Peach Brown Betty. 4 cups soft white breadcrumbs, about 6 slices of bread. 1/3 cup butter melted. 1 cup white sugar. 4 large peaches, pitted and peeled, cut into 1/4-inch slices. Mix breadcrumbs and butter in a bowl and stir to combine. Butter a 2-quart casserole and layer it with the peach crumbs, peaches, and sugar. Continue layering and end with breadcrumbs. Bake in a 350-degree oven for about 30 minutes or until peaches are tender. Serve with whipped cream if desired. Recipe adapted from the Veneta Indian Territory Daily Chieftain, November 27, 1899.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.